This breakfast discussion with Noam Chomsky was recorded when Chomsky was on a visit to Dublin in November 2009. It's between five members of the Workers' Solidarity Movement and Chomsky. You'll find more audio files and information about the WSM at www.wsm.ie.
In the States, worked with Voices. Do you know Voices? It used to be called Voices in the Wilderness, and it's called Voices for Creative Nonviolence now. And we, you know, we were in Iraq and Lebanon and just...
You were too?
Yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. I was in Lebanon during the last war and...
2006 war.
In 2006, yeah. Uh-huh. Myself and Kathy and a few mm-hmm. of us from Voices.
You were connected with Kathy Kelly in this?
Yeah, I've worked in Voices for about 8 years now, yeah. But, you know, Voices does national campaigns. Yeah. So I lived in the office in 2005 and 2006 and went to Iraq with them in 2002. But when we were in Lebanon, we took, you know, we were there with the ISM people, like with Huwaida and Adam Shapiro and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they had organized a protest for us to drive from Beirut to the south during the war, because that was, the Israelis were saying they were going to bomb anything, and we said you can't bomb civilians, but they were obviously bombing civilians. Like, but we took, you know, lots of testimony, lots of pictures, wrote tons, and there's just, I get frustrated. I don't know what you can really do. It didn't seem like, I don't think people in the U.S. had any idea, or anywhere
you
else outside.
Can't carry out nonviolent protest against jet planes.
Well, we can try, though.
I mean, we can try and shoot them down. And in fact, that may happen next time.
Yeah.
Probably Hezbollah's picked up anti-aircraft equipment, pretty advanced anti-aircraft equipment, according to Bob Fisk, who I saw the other day.
But still, I still don't think people realize what the Israelis did to Lebanon during, and definitely with this whole, with Gaza, like people don't realize either, you know,
here?
Still,
is,
yeah.
Is there a Gaza protest? It seems to be a
there
fair
were.
Amount of Gaza protests.
There is a group here, yeah, they're quite active, the Irish-Palestinian Solidarity Campaign.
Yeah, I was impressed.
Yeah.
There's various different groups here. For example, I'm involved in the group Viva Palestina in Cork, and we have ambulances and stuff like that. We're joining the convoy going over. There's Free Gaz is very strong in Ireland. I mean,
yeah, I met a guy,
Graham
up in Belfast, John
Hurston, yeah, from Tyrone.
He led the Tyrone to Gaza parade. He's going again.
Yeah. But, I mean, what we were talking about in Lebanon there, didn't they call, I mean, with Goldstone report coming out there recently, where they found Israel guilty of war crimes, but didn't Israel find themselves guilty of war crimes by what they call the Dahiya strategy, where they said in Lebanon
in
2006? Huh?
They don't call it a war crime.
No, but they say we're going to target everybody.
They said they'd use one, some general said, you know, like it was on a government announcement. The Goldstone report, I think, it's good that they're pushing it, but it's really flawed fundamentally. And we shouldn't forget that. It presupposes, and Goldstone's explicit about it, that Israel had the right to attack. It just didn't, it was disproportionate. It's kind of like the human rights groups. But they, you know, why'd they have a right to attack? I mean, nothing. They could have had a peaceful settlement if they wanted, and they knew it. There was a ceasefire. There's a lot of lying going on about that. The New Yorker just came out with a big cover story written by some well-known Middle East correspondent who just lies flat out. You know, he says that Israel offered a ceasefire, but Hamas refused. It's exactly the other way around. And that's front page story. And nobody's going to say anything about it. But, you know, even legally, unless you've tried peaceful means and the right to use force, and they've not only not tried it, but they've rejected it. And that's actually the U.S., it's not Israel. So skeptical about the... I think my feeling is the support for the Goldstone report ought to be qualified. You know, the right on the narrow issue that they discussed, you know, disproportionate use of force. But, you know, we didn't... I mean, Nuremberg isn't about disproportionate use of force. Mm.
But Goldstone himself refused to even investigate, because the original mandate, I believe, was to investigate the crime of the occupying power.
No.
And he insisted that Hamas be included also. Is that correct?
he accused, well, yeah, they criticized both. Okay. That part I don't mind in any case of Hamas committed a war crime. But the real thing is, it was just shocking. It was just aggression. It's unprovoked aggression where the aggressor refuses to accept peaceful means and then claims the right to attack. If they'd fired one bullet, it would have been a war crime. The disproportionate use of force, yeah, okay, that makes it worse. But, it's also a problem for the tactics of the Palestinian solidarity movements. I've been arguing with them about this for years, but it seems to me like BDS, for example, makes sense, but it should be directed against the United States. I mean, Israel go exactly as far as the U.S. alone go. In fact, they're using U.S. equipment, relying on U.S. diplomatic support. It's like criticizing, you know, the hand but not the brain. You know? And if you want to change policy, it's going to have to change the U.S. policy. It was the same with South Africa. I mean, back in the early 60s, South Africa was becoming a pariah state internationally, like, you know, U.N. votes and that sort of thing. But a South African minister actually told the U.S. Counterpart that they didn't really care about UN votes because there's only one vote at the UN, and as long as that vote supports them, they don't really care what happens anywhere else. And when finally it got to the point where the US officially opposed them, by 1980 or so there were congressional resolutions and so on, and so Reagan, who was a total monster, but he had to find ways to get around congressional resolutions to keep supporting South Africa. And at that point, BDS really took off because it had official U.S. support and corporate support. But until, as long as the U.S. is backing them, there's no point attacking South Africa. Mm-hmm.
But for us as Irish activists, then, say, in terms of our government's complicity, we mentioned Intel setting up in Israel for reasons, you know, they're to do with their access to European markets under the Euro
agreement. It's kind of like Ireland. There's an educated, high-tech educated population, a cheap workforce.
But Irish activists should be therefore targeting our government's deals with Israel.
It's a little tricky because, you know, the Irish government isn't responsible for Intel's decision to move to Israel. That's the problem. It's probably California's.
But we could suspend the Euromed agreement. We could have at least until the adoption of the Lisbon Treaty, which should have been what maybe Irish activists were aiming towards. I think the Irish government's rhetoric is good on Israel. Generally, it's very, you know. For example, the EU in 2006 they completely ignored the election of 2006. And then our Minister for Foreign Affairs says something along the lines of, Micheál Martin said, we should be backing the Palestinian Authority with the same funds that
they
were backing Israel. But that's calling for us to back a non-elected tyranny on the West Bank.
That's not only it's a non-elected tyranny, but Abbas's term ran out about 8 months ago. He's not president. But yeah, that's good. That's the only government I know of that's where anyone's taken that position. I don't know of anyone else in Europe who didn't. I mean, George Galloway. Not in the government.
But I think it's rhetorical. I think it's purely rhetoric.
It's just rhetoric.
Yeah, because in terms of their actions, I mean, it's not like we talked about the Irish activists that are involved with Palestine. It's not like somebody in our Foreign Affairs Department isn't aware of the real issues. And for 40 years, we haven't done anything.
You might check this, because it's hard to find, because we were just talking about it, that a couple of weeks ago, in the middle of all the Iran furor, the International Atomic Energy Agency passed a resolution calling on Israel to open its nuclear facilities and to join the non-proliferation treaty. Europe tried to block it, and Europe voted against it with the U.S. And it wasn't the only newspaper, English language newspaper in the world to record it this year.
Yeah, times are.
But did Ireland vote with Europe on that?
It has to be unanimous, as far as I'm aware.
Pardon?
The EU has to be unanimous.
Unanimous.
Ireland could have stopped.
So they could have stopped.
Ireland can stop EU.
Or at least they could vote for the resolution, you know, which at least abstain, you know, not try to block it.
So hard to do. It's so hard to do pro-Palestinian activism in the U.S. But I was in... I went to UPenn and was in the Penn Students for Justice in Palestine group, and we tried to, like, we couldn't book rooms in certain parts of the university. We had no courage from any professors, even, you know, really sort of progressive professors wouldn't come out in support of us. I mean,
in recent years.
Yeah, I just graduated in 2008, so yeah, incredible.
Palestinian style solidarity. Mm-hmm. And they did it.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a BDS campaign, I think.
Yeah, we had... it's not really applicable to Ireland, but it is, like, I just remember being so frustrated with our own professors. Like, we got Ian Lustig sometimes would speak on it, but...
He wouldn't come out and speak on it.
But nobody ever would show support. We'd always have a really, really hard time bringing any of our speakers and getting them approved by the Middle East Center there. And I don't know if that's because the Middle East Center there is run by this...
That's normal, but you can get around it. But I remember a couple of years ago I was invited at the University of Michigan by a small, tiny Palestine solidarity group, and they got the Middle East Center to allow me to come and give a seminar, so they'd pay the airfare.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was huge protests from the faculty, including the liberal faculty, and in fact, spearheaded by them. And they finally got the Middle East Center to withdraw the invitation, so they were all upset, you know. But I told them it's great, you know, what you should do is, wait, I'll come anyway, okay. But get the student newspaper a couple of days before the event to go to talk to the professors and ask them why they're opposed to allowing a seminar on this. And I figured what would happen, and what did happen, is the professors all ran for the woodwork. They didn't want to talk. So the student newspaper had a big article, you know, exposing cowardly academics. And we finally ended up with an event. Instead of a seminar, it was at the biggest auditorium on campus, a couple of thousand students. You can get around those things.
We could, but we usually had to put in all of our own money and things in order to get anything.
You know, it's not a huge sum of money. I mean, and then, you know, you can collect money and the thing usually makes up for it. And you also get people interested and engage.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
yeah.
They have a way. They really are shooting themselves in the foot. And they can get away with it as long as it's not exposed. As soon as it gets exposed, you know, they run away and you get a lot of student interest.
Yeah, it's just that it couldn't even do, like, it would be just the opening of debate, you know, that's all, even, which seems very simple thing that universities should be doing was just very difficult, let alone any other kind of activism, you know, but anyway.
Just in terms of media control, I was wondering, not being an American, how the crisis has been represented in the mainstream.
The
financial crisis, how it's been represented to the people and the working class in the mainstream American media.
Partially accurately. I mean, they are reporting, like, you can read in the New York Times and so on, that the big banks are making out like bandits. And it's caused a lot of outrage. But the trouble is, that's where it stops. What it doesn't go beyond is to explain why. And the end result of that is that the Murdoch right is taking over. I mean, they have an answer. They say, you know, it's the rich liberals who own the banks and giving everything away to illegal aliens, and they don't care about the people and so on. That's where you're getting the tea parties and the demonstrations. And people are really angry, and they have a right to be angry. And the only answer they're getting is from lunatics. You know, Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin. So it's kind of like it's a little like early Nazi Germany, where the Nazis were appealing to the same grievances, and they were giving answers, you know, crazy answers, but nobody was giving good answers. And it's the problem here is that, and of course the liberal Democrats can't give the right answer. They can't say, you know, their wages have stagnated for 30 years because we're supporting neoliberal policies. I'm not going to say that. You know. So what they're stuck with is Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin. And you know, it could lead to a very dangerous right-wing backlash, because the grievances are very real and they're not being addressed.
Yeah,
and what liberals do is just ridicule it. They say, you know, look how stupid they think they're death panels. That's not the right reaction. Yeah.
What do you think the anarchist response should be, or how can we?
The answer should be, these are the policies we've followed for 30 years since Carter, which financialized the economy and destroyed the productive system, and we did it because it enriches rich people and strengthens finance capital. But you know, what liberal Democrats won't tell them that. And these are the policies of Clinton, Carter, Obama. And the Republicans haven't carried a little farther, but no real division on it. In fact, the guys who were direct Obama's financial advisors, you know, these guys ought to be in jail. Rubin, Lawrence Summers, they're the guys who created the crisis in the Clinton administration. You know, I would totally do it, but they laid the basis for it.
One of the major kind of problems that we have in Ireland is that the government and the media seem to be trying to draw a huge divide between the public and the private sector and effectively blame the entire recession on the public sector. And it's calls for services to be cut and for pay cuts and everything else. And one of the big problems is that the unions in Ireland mostly cover the public sector, so they're seen as only representing public sector workers.
Same in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what do you think we can do about that?
Build the labor movement. I mean, there's been, ever since the Second World War, I'm sure here too, there's just been a major concerted campaign to undermine unions. So unions are, you know, they're really hated by a lot of the people who should be supporting them, because they're seen, not totally without reason, as defending a, you know, kind of a workers' elite and letting everyone else go. And that's part of the reason why there's no health care in the United States. If you compare the United States with Canada, you know, fairly similar societies, back in the 50s, the Canadian unions and the U.S. unions were both the same, like UAW, it's the same union, but different sides of the border. They were both kind of campaigning, pressing for health care, but differently. Canada wanted it for the population. The UAW in the United States wanted it for themselves. And they did get good benefits. So the UAW package was a good package, but not for anyone else. And of course, it's a compact with the company. Well, you know, the company's fighting a class war. The UAW thought they were cooperating. And in fact, by the time they realized, it's too late. You know, Doug Fraser, the head of the UAW in the United States, made a very bitter speech. He said, look, this is terrible. They're fighting a one-sided class war against us. Yeah, big deal. What do you think they're supposed to be doing?
You're the other side.
Can you give any suggestions? What should Irish, what should anarchists and what should Irish workers then be doing to kind of counter that anti-union kind of culture?
There's never any magic key to this. Mm-hmm. It's just education and organization. And you have to have tactics that relate to the level of people's understanding, mm-hmm. and perception, and the focus on meaningful goals. There's just no magic key. It's the way unions were developed in the first place. It's the way they have to fight back.
And how should we view the union bureaucracy in that case, then? Should it?
It's usually the enemy. But,
yeah.
But if the workforce trusts them, you can't just come in and say, you know, they're your enemy.
Yeah.
You have to,
mm-hmm.
have to understand why.
I got off a bus this morning in O'Connell Street. There was a statue of Jim Larkin there, who probably organized workers as well as anybody in, I don't know, in Europe in 100 years ago. We have to go back to that kind of, you know, understanding of class consciousness among workers. Is that what you're talking about?
That's absolutely true. I mean, the business classes are Marxists, basically. I mean, they talk like that even. You know, they're worried about the masses and, you know, the rising political power of the masses and so on. But they're kind of, you know, vulgar Marxists with the values inverted. And if the working class accepts the, you know, we're all in one big family line, they're in bad trouble. They've got to face the reality of ongoing class war.
our union bureaucracy for maybe since 87, about 22 years or so, has been involved in what's called partnership here, which is, you know, basically an arranged agreement with the bosses that this is what wage rises will be, and we'll take, by the way, the profits will all go to the bosses. It's similar to the collateral syndicates in Italy, isn't it? I mean, is that the kind of arrangement in...
Well, I don't know the Irish situation closely enough to judge, but from what I understand, there was some rationale to that. I mean, it was a way of permitting a larger section of the workforce to take part in the so-called Celtic miracle. They kept wages down, and that did encourage investment and brought in more of the workforce. So if I understand, it's kind of an ambivalent issue. I know guys like O'Toole, for example, supported it, thought it was a good thing because that was giving a broader range of the workforce a chance to take part in.
But the end result, my own analysis, and the end result of partnership over 20 years has been a weakening of unions in Ireland. And the profits have been pocketed by...
Oh, that's true. So, but how do you balance it? How do you balance that against allowing, you know, when you appeal to poor people, working people, how can you come out against an arrangement which gives them jobs? That's the trick.
And that's one of the major problems we have in Ireland, because we had such mass immigration and unemployment not that long ago at all. So it's that fear of going back to that.
Right, back in
everybody's
mind.
Very vibrant in this
country. And now facing it.
And it's really difficult when you get like the heads of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, for example. They were the ones basically that put the pension levy on the table instead of a wage cut, because it would be more appealable, basically. And 120,000 workers took to the streets, basically calling for a general strike. And in light of social partnership, the union heads basically went into talks with the government and came up with, you know, solutions. And it never happened. And like it was very demoralizing for the left and for the workers' movement here, when I think they really saw a big potential which was never really capitalized on. It was difficult.
You know, it's the degeneration of the worker solidarity over the last years has been pretty remarkable. In fact, there was a striking example of it early this year. Obama wanted to show his support for working people, so he was undermining everything that he promised to do. But so what he did was he went to a factory in Illinois to give a talk, I love you, that sort of thing. And the factory he chose was Caterpillar. So there were protests from peace and church groups because of what Caterpillar's up to, but there were no protests from the labor movement. And it's just 15 years ago, early 90s, when Obama was in Chicago, he's got to know about it. It was all over the Chicago Tribune. The right-wing newspaper happens to carry labor issues very well. And Caterpillar in the early 90s was the first manufacturing corporation in generations to call in scabs to break up a strike. And even the labor historians don't know about it. But the striking part about it was that even in Peoria, Illinois, where the Caterpillar plant is, you know, it's a town that was built by the union, these strikers did not get community support because of the collapse of the working class culture during, you know, Reagan years. Caterpillar was basically following the model of Reagan and the plant controllers, but they were the first industrial corporation to do it. And that's where Obama goes to give his solidarity speech, and nobody objected. I mean, even the radical, a couple of the like labor notes, you know, those guys, they objected, but practically nobody else.
When you compare that, so to, say, worker struggles in Argentina when they had an economic crisis in 2001.
See, but then it was, the crisis really destroyed the economy, like it was down to zero. And then you had spontaneous revolts. Now, there's little bits of that in the United States, but you know, business cut them off very fast. Like, for example, did you follow the Republic?
Windows and Doors.
Windows and Doors, yeah, in Chicago.
Yeah.
Well, there it got to the point of sit-ins, but then we're planning to take over the plant. Okay, at that point, the multinational, or the big banks, or whoever it was who owned the thing, instead of closing it down, sold it off. A lot of the workers got their jobs back, and they didn't take the next step, which was imminent. You know. And I had a lot of stuff just below the surface. And they just had these auto plants that are being shut down. I mean, you know, what's going on is kind of surreal. You know, the auto plants are being, the industrial plants are being shut down. The Obama administration's has got officials, often in Spain and France, using federal stimulus money to purchase high-speed rail technology, which could be built in those plants. But, you know, for the banks and so on, it's not worth it. So they'd rather shut them down and use taxpayer money to buy it from Spain. But if the communities and the workforce had reached the right level of consciousness, they would just take over the plant, reconstruct it, and start producing high-speed rail transport.
We had a situation in Waterford Crystal Plant where the workers had a sit-in.
What's going on here?
And, well, ultimately what happened in Chicago Windows and Doors, they found somebody to buy it and pay redundancy. But there was also one in Belfast in the
Vestion.
And you know, these kind of struggles are what you're talking about in America. So what you're saying is just under the surface of the sit-ins.
It's just under the surface.
Comes the, we're going to take over and run ourselves.
That's why they're so afraid of sit-ins. Go back to the New Deal. I mean, as soon as workers started sitting in, that's when the legislation was quickly passed. And, you know, the big corporations started supporting Roosevelt. Because the next step beyond the sit-in is, well, why don't we take it over?
Which is what they did in Argentina.
Yeah, exactly.
But they did it in Argentina after everything had collapsed.
Yeah.
I mean, so there was nothing was functioning anymore. So you either starve or no alternative.
But it's still an inspiration we can take. I mean,
well, it's an inspiration you can take. And but you don't want to wait until everything collapsed. I mean, they can do it right now.
Yeah.
And in fact, there have been a couple of attempts. There was an interesting case. Maybe you followed it in Youngstown, Ohio, which is a steel town, and U.S. Steel, which owned it, decided to transfer the operation. Anyway, closed down the plants. And there was a lot of protest, community protest, you know, sit-ins, the whole business. And finally, Staunton Lynn, you know him? He's a kind of a left labor activist and also a lawyer. So he took he was acting in the civil rights movement, so he got them to take a case to the courts demanding that the courts permit the community to take over, and the workforce take over the plants instead of having them trashed. And they sort of made it part way through the courts. They ultimately didn't make it. But if there'd been enough general popular support, they would have made it, and they'd have taken over the plants. And you know, that kind of stuff is not too far below the surface, I think. And that's where I think anarchists or labor activists ought to be pushing. Because if there's enough understanding, consciousness, then you can take that next step, and that could make a huge difference. And that would be, you know, the constructive way out of the recession. Let's just take it over. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that far from awareness. I can see, you know, even talking, giving talks in the working class areas, you know, people sort of think it's kind of reasonable. And in fact, you know, that's labor history. You go back to the United States too, they never heard about European, you know, Marxism or anything like that, but the working class was very radical. Late 19th century, the common feeling was just take over the plant. In fact, wage labor was regarded as kind of like slavery, except it's temporary. And it was so popular, it was a slogan of the Republican Party, even Abraham Lincoln. And I don't really think it's far below the surface. And, but, you know, somebody's got to light that spark.
You talked about the importance of education. How do we deal with kind of the apathy, people who say that maybe politics and economics are just not that relevant to them, just find it boring, or they find terms like anarchism, socialism, class just
so
really
off the terms. Drop the terms and talk about what you do when U.S. Steel is destroying your community. And why don't we just take over the plant? You don't have to call it anarchy. That's what it is. Who cares what the term is? Yeah, the terms scare people because he's been there for a scare campaign for a century.
And what do you think is the best way of communicating that? What do you think is the best way of communicating that? We have paper and magazines and we do public meetings. Is there anything else that we can do? Website?
House to house organizing, neighborhood meetings. I mean, say the anti-war movement in the United States, the anti-Vietnam War movement. I mean, the war actually started in the early 60s. Kennedy started the war. Nobody cared. And the first meetings were in a neighbor's living room or in a church with four people, you know, and stuff like that. And it gradually developed. Same with the civil rights movement. Or take the women's movement. I mean, it didn't really take off till the 70s, but in the 60s, there were just consciousness-raising groups, you know, small groups of women talking to each other.
In terms of that Caterpillar strike that you mentioned earlier, where they got no community support, and then Tane mentioned earlier that there seems to be a wedge trying to be driven between public and private sector workers. What do you think the media's role is in doing that, driving that wedge between...
Who do the media work for? How many labor reporters are there? And how many business reporters in the Irish Times?
Yeah.
Regarding the Irish media, and I don't know what the others think, but there was it was instructed to me anyway about, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks ago, to the last two, say, IRA prisoners that have been in, were released. And there was a furore in the media that, you know, they killed a policeman here. And they were released after serving their sentence, and there was a furore all over the media because a politician went and met them as they got released from prison.
A Sinn Féin
politician went to meet them as they got released from prison, and it was just criticism all through the media, but nobody mentioned that we are facilitating one of the biggest crimes of the century in allowing the US military to land in Shannon, and that the upper echelons of our government are complicit in that crime. It just wasn't reported. I mean, can you talk about that as a crime and why the media don't see fit to report these things?
No, why? We don't have to explain to each other why. I mean, that's their role. They're doing their job. You know, the media are part of a state corporate system. I mean, what should be praised is that occasionally they break out. Like, for example, reporting the International Atomic Agency report. Oh, that's good. In fact, I praise them for being the only newspaper in the English-speaking world that reported something critically significant. But most of the time, they're doing their job. And it's not, you know, if you know journalists and editors and so on, you know, you're about to know a lot of them. They believe in what they're doing. And just like Soviet party hacks believe in what they're doing.
But it's easy for an Irish newspaper to be critical of the USA or Israel. It's not easy for them to be critical of their own power structure.
Yeah, but that's typical. It's always easier to criticize someone else. I mean, that's why in England and Ireland, too, the Balkans are kind of worse than Israel and the United States. You just can't talk about it. Because there we're criticizing someone else's crimes. Mm-hmm. And that's great. We love that.
That's been seen a lot in the Shell campaign. I don't know if you talked about this before, but the media basically went on a crusade against the Shell to Sea campaign.
Against?
The Shell to Sea campaign, sure. Because the head of the Independent basically owns a lot of the media in Ireland, and it's very much in his interest that the oil does go to Shell and that the Irish government doesn't capitalize it. And it was crazy to see some of our activists trying so hard to kind of highlight to society what this giveaway really meant, and being stunted all the time by the forces of the media portraying the Shell to Sea campaign as inherently bad and against, you know, against productivity. And
well, look, I mean, the media critique, it's a good thing to do. I mean, I spent a lot of time on it, too. But, you know, you can't act as if you're surprised. I mean, yes, it's like, you know, objecting to General Motors because they try to make profits. Well, yeah, what else are they supposed to do? But if they ever break out of the pattern briefly, fine, you know, support them. And when you do media critique, it's not to try to change the media. It's to get people to understand the difference between the world and what passes through the filters. So you're talking to the population, not the editors. They know what they're doing.
Do you think that at the moment grassroots groups should be focusing on advocating strikes and protests, or should they be sort of building things like social centres, there's sort of community gardens, co-ops?
Well, you know better than I do. It depends on the conditions. Yeah. Like, take, say, tomorrow's demonstration. Yeah. I mean, does the population understand what it's about, or are they alienated by it?
I think there's a general position that it's the public service protecting their pay, basically.
Actually, I thought, you know, I don't know if to say anything, but I did watch. I was interviewed on, what's his name, Pat Penny or somebody the other night, and I was sitting there in the first part of the program where there was a kind of a debate about, mostly about tomorrow's demonstration. And there was an audience, and you know, the audience, I mean, I talked to a lot of the people in the audience, and they're kind of, you know, what you call ordinary people, kind of like off the streets, a lot of them working class people. And they were very split about it. I mean, a lot of them just privately, you know, talking in the halls. I mean, a lot of them thought it's just an attack on the public. It's an attack on us, on working people. Well, you know, if you carry off a demonstration under those circumstances, it's harmful. If you have public understanding, it's different. It's kind of like, say, the anti-war protests back in the 60s when they split off into... The student movement kind of broke up. It self-destructed, like a lot of the left does, in the late 60s. And part of it went off to Maoist cults. And the guys are handing out leaflets at the GE plant, and who the hell knows what they're talking about. And the other part went into the weathermen. You know, let's break some windows and we'll bring down the state. But, of course, they just alienated everyone. So the whole thing turned into like a gift to Richard Nixon. But... So you really have to think through, you know, where is the audience? Mm-hmm. What are they ready for? What do they understand? Mm-hmm. And what should they understand? Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, what we were talking about before, say, taking over a factory, I think that's something that people could understand. And they ought to know the history. In the United States, they ought to know their own history, like the working class struggles against wage labor, which were... Mm-hmm. So broad that they included Abraham Lincoln. People know that, you know, and they ought to realize it's perfectly sound practice. It's even standard economics texts will tell you there's nothing in our crazy theory that says anything about it. That if so-called stakeholders, community and workforce take over a corporation, it's fine. They can run in their interests. And that's pretty straightforward. You don't have to use scare words, you know, anarchism, communism, stuff like that. But, you know, always tactics have to be adapted to the circumstances. I mean, there are kind of feel-good tactics, but that's no use. I mean, what you need is ones that work.
Do you have any opinions about why there are so few women that get involved in politics, and in particular politics like anarchism, for example?
I'm sure it's true. I mean, there's plenty of women now and in the past. I mean, take, say, Women's Strike for Peace, a big organization, one of the most militant anti-war and anti-nuclear groups. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is the oldest NGO. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty good. I mean, you know, they don't go out and demonstrate in the streets, but it's good, solid work. And the anarchist tradition certainly has many, you know, the Emma Goldmans and other Mother Jones. And right now, I mean, take, say, people like, you know, Naomi Klein and others are very prominent. Arundhati Roy is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, that's probably more true now than before with the results of the feminist movement, you know, the kind of breakthrough in the general public. Now, there are many less barriers than there were. I mean, like, say, back in the Spanish Civil War, the women, leaders in the anarchist movement, like Federico Manzoni, were supporting the sexist practices. You know, there were Spanish cultures. It's just kind of like built into it. It's radically anti-feminist, like you're supposed to make fun of women in the streets and so on. And she was supporting it. She said, yeah, that's the way we like it and so on. But it wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it, I think it is, it's difficult in our own organization. There are a few women. When I'm studying Islamic feminism, and a lot of people don't know that some of the biggest social justice movements in the Middle East today are women's rights movements, especially my family's from Iran. In Iran, for example, even in this past horrible election that they had, women's rights were on the agenda for someone like Ahmadinejad or even Mousavi, all these people vetted by the Guardian Council, had to talk about women's rights.
One of the reasons why he has popular support is that he was supporting women's rights.
Yeah,
by standards at a pretty high level, so letting women be in the audience in soccer games and stuff, which was breaking. But that means that. Did you come across Malalai Joya?
Yeah, she is wonderful.
Example.
Yeah.
But she's been, and she had tremendous support from women. Mm-hmm. I mean, enough support to get into the parliament. Afghan women, the feminist movement in Afghanistan precedes that in the United States.
Yeah.
And women got the right to vote in the early, around 1920.
Yeah, and the same in Iran, too. Iranian constitutional revolution had women members and have been. It's in this perception that, women don't have rights in a lot of Islamic countries, but they're extremely, I think, strong.
Pakistan had a woman prime minister long before the United States had anything like
right.
that.
Where do you think continue to pay attention today? I'm going right after this, going to a protest at the Iranian embassy for the ongoing executions of scholars and things. Do you have any thoughts on what's going on in Iran in terms of a possible human rights pro democracy movement? It got repressed. I mean, it hasn't been paid attention to much recently, but.
Do you know Maria Bagramian of the CD?
Yeah, she's in our group too, yes.
She's the person you should really ask about this, because she herself was an Iranian dissident, but she keeps close touch with the current movements. I was talking to her last night about it. In fact, I have to see her in 10 minutes. She's looking at me. But she keeps very close touch and has friends and so on. And she says she just can't tell. I mean, everything's kind of like on the edge, could be anyway.
Right.
I'm asking her what she thinks is going to happen tomorrow. And it's today or tomorrow when they have the 30th anniversary.
Right.
The tradition has been to demonstrate outside the U.S. Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
But any demonstrations now are illegal. And it looks like there is going to be a demonstration, but nobody knows if it's going to be working up violently.
Right,
the last one they kind of allowed, even on Palestine Day, even though it was illegal. But this one, who knows? Will it be at the American Embassy? Will it be somewhere else? But whatever's going to happen is kind of clandestine, so it will happen, and then you'll find out.
Yeah.
It's a very touchy situation.
It is.
It's also unclear how we can best help them.
Yeah.
If you take a strong stand against the government, it's good from one point of view, but it also gives the government a weapon. It helps them pursue their the rhetoric about how the demonstrations are just a Western plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in fact, the dissidents themselves, people like Shirin Ebadi and others, have they've suggested toning it down for that reason.
Mm.
Not in favor of protests against the repression and everything else, but don't want it to take a form which could be exploited by the ruling clerics.
Right,
it's a tricky line to follow. And you basically have to follow their lead, what they want you to do. On the Afghan thing, I think there's something very concrete that can be done. Like, you know, a huge debate going on, what do we do in Afghanistan? There's one voice missing, Afghans, not asked.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are people with voices, like Malalai Joya,
yeah,
who speaks for a large number of people. That's how she got elected. And there is an Afghan peace movement. And it seems to me people here ought to say, okay, let's hear what they have to say.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Say.
Did you see, like, Code Pink recently that went over, they have these delegations over to Afghanistan, and
yeah,
they came out and said, yeah, we spoke to the Afghan women, and if you really care about Afghani women's rights, you wouldn't support a timetable for U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And in Code Pink is huge in the United States. So if they're saying this, like, a lot of people will say, oh, yeah, you know, I heard this from Code Pink.
That's what they heard. But did they talk to Rawa? Did they talk to...
No, Jared? Absolutely. Like, yeah.
Well, okay, so you got to ask who they're talking to.
Yeah. It was very disappointing for me.
But, you know,
that they came out like that.
Did you read Joya's book?
I haven't read. No, I just saw her interview on Democracy Now!
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Pretty impressive, but what she points out is, and she's probably right, that as far as Afghan women are concerned, if I matter generally, they're just caught between awful forces.
Yeah.
There's the Taliban, the maniacs, there's the warlords who are gangsters, and that's the government. There's the army, which is horrible, you know, the American army. So they're stuck between these. Where do you find a way out? You don't want to find a way out that leaves one of these forces in power.
Yeah, and then you have...
But it's really for them to decide, not for us.
And you have, like, U.S. and European, what do you call them, ambassadors saying things, read in the Irish Times, saying things that we don't want to say anything to the Afghan government about how they should treat their women, you know, because that's culturally insensitive of us, you know, like, and it's
when
just...
When we're supporting them, we're telling them how to treat their women.
Exactly,
in
no,
yeah,
exactly, yeah.
So. And in fact, you know, the Karzai government is basically a warlord government.
Yeah.
And they're as bad as anyone else.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, and this has been pretty well suppressed in the West, maybe here too, probably the best period for women, at least in Kabul,
mm-hmm,
it was in the Russian occupation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Russians were secular, whatever you think about them. So women were attending Kabul University in miniskirts, and classes were mixed, and
yeah,
it was pretty open. In fact, the big problem they had was with the U.S.-backed Islamic radicals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guys like Massoud and Hikmatyar were throwing acid in the faces of people. There's a couple of articles about this, which by a well-known international feminist activist, Rasul Basu, she was Indian. She's one of the people who organized the 1974 International Women's UN Women's Day. She happened to be the UN delegate in Kabul, specifically for women's rights, in the late 80s. And she wrote about this and submitted articles that press wouldn't write them, but even Ms. Magazine wouldn't publish them.
Really?
Yeah, you know, because it was sort of a long political line. You know. She finally published them in Asia Times or something like that, so nobody saw them.
I wanted to ask you briefly about Palestinian solidarity groups like Free Gaza and Viva Palestina. Just maybe what you think of, I don't know, the Viva Palestina movement generally, and basically solidarity with Palestinians, how that's helping them, you know, whether international solidarity can eventually help end the siege in Gaza and eventually end the occupation.
Free Gaza movement, and in fact the whole international solidarity movement, has been a really inspiring development. And it started in the 80s, directed to Central America, since spread all over the world. It's something totally new in the history of imperialism, never anything like it. And it's pretty effective. I mean, in the case of Gaza, the constant efforts to break the siege, whether they work or not, they're a step forward. I mean, if Israel, you know, rams the boats and takes them to shore, okay, then that's an organizing technique. If they get through, that's great. You're getting some humanitarian aid. And it's very courageous. You know, people have been killed, a lot have been beaten. Maria Maguire, who's taken part in these things, has been, you know, kidnapped by the Israeli Navy, you know, shot by Israeli forces. Unfortunately, it's not well known. I suppose it's known in Ireland, but in the United States, it doesn't get reported. These are really important moves. And I guess that's the one thing that can, sooner or later, turn U.S. government policy. And that's the real target. Because as long as the U.S. government continues to support and participate in the Israeli occupation, it'll be like South Africa. As long as the United States openly supported it, South Africans didn't care if everyone else was against it. I mentioned before, a South African minister who told his U.S. counterpart back in the early 60s that we don't really care if the U.N. votes against us because there's only one vote. That's yours. And it's what it means to be the sovereign of the world. So as long as you're with us, we can forget the rest. And Israel's in the same situation. So I think that target, that one goal is to help the Palestinians directly, and they need it. I mean, it's bad enough in the West Bank, terrible in the West Bank, but Gaza's just criminal. So anything that can help them is fine, but also tactics that'll aim to build up opposition to U.S. government policies internationally in the United States and compel a shift of policy there and get them to join the world. And that's critically significant.
Which means EU and Irish policy also.
Means here too. I mean, if the European Union kind of toddles along behind the United States, it's more support for U.S. policies. And they don't have to. I mean, Europe can take an independent stand, and Ireland can help push Europe towards an independent stand. And that'll depend on the understanding and mood of people here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, real good to meet you. Thanks. Sorry, I got to rush off. I'm off to the airport.
This breakfast discussion with Noam Chomsky was recorded when Chomsky was on a visit to Dublin in November 2009. It's between five members of the Workers' Solidarity Movement and Chomsky. You'll find more audio files and information about the WSM at www.wsm.ie.